Okay, I'm going to call to order this February 3rd, 2014 meeting of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, our first meeting of this 2014 session. And today's a short meeting, colleagues. We're of course barred from having public hearings today, but we are going to take advantage of today, obviously, to adopt our rules. But also, we're fortunate to have Janet Newman, who is going to be here to talk to us about water rights. Just to give us a refresher, I think, maybe for some of you, a good primer for others, background for some of the issues we're going to be addressing over the next month. So with that, I'm going to first open an organizational meeting of the committee. And Vice Chair Olson, would you like to make a motion, please?
Chair Denbrough, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2014.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2014. Before we get into discussion, Beth, these are our standard rules along with what was adopted today on the Senate floor?
Correct. So these would be similar to the last February session rules and the rules that have been adopted in the other committees today.
Okay. And that does include a requirement that amendments be available to the public at least an hour before they're voted on. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. And colleagues, I would encourage you, I would urge you, let's put it that way, if you have an amendment to any legislation, if you could get it in as quickly as possible, as early as possible. I know that isn't always allowable, you know, time doesn't allow, but the more that we can get them and get them out to everyone on the committee, so that when you sit here, it's not the first time you really have a chance to look at it and give us all some time to think
helpful.
About it.
Yeah.
Let's really shoot for that. Okay. Okay. Is there any discussion of the rules? Okay. Seeing none. Is there any objection to the rules? Okay. Seeing none. The rules are adopted. I will close the organizational meeting. And now I will open the informational meeting on water right transfers and the adjudication process. Thank you, Janet.
Okay. Chair Denbrough and members of the committee, I'm Dan Newman, currently senior counsel with the Tonkin Torp Law Firm in Portland, where I work with the Environmental and Natural Resource Practice Groups, primarily concentrating on water law. But perhaps more relevant for today's purposes, until just a couple of years ago, I was on the faculty at Lewis and Clark Law School, where I taught water law and other subjects, property law and so forth, for almost 20 years. And I do want to just say, for the record, that I do have one client in the Klamath adjudication. They know I'm here today. I'm not talking on their behalf or against their interest in any way, but I just wanted to put that on the record. I'd like to thank you for giving me the invitation to come here today. And what I'm going to do is to give you a very condensed summary of a couple of important aspects of Oregon water law. I think at least a couple of you were on the committee last session when I spoke of Water Law 101, kind of the overview of the entire system. So I'm not going to go back and do that again today, but I will certainly go back to basic questions about that for anyone who wants to. And what I'll try to do instead is outline in the next little bit of time the basic framework of how adjudications and transfers work under the Water Code to provide you with context for some bills that I understand you will be considering shortly. And I am happy to take questions at any point. I also think that Beth reserved some time for questions at the end, so I will go ahead and get started. Before talking about specifically about adjudications and transfers, let me set out the bigger picture very briefly, not the whole Water Law 101, but a little bit about how these pieces fit into the Water Code and its history. In 1909, the Oregon legislature adopted the state's first comprehensive water code, and it's pretty much intact today. I mean, with a couple of significant additions, we still have basically the same system. And we were not the first in the West. The earliest comprehensive water code was 1899 in Wyoming, but we followed fairly soon after. The code declared that going forward, the state would use the prior appropriation doctrine for its water law. And basically what that means is first in time, first in right, use it or lose it. So the senior water rights have the best priority. And in times of shortage, which are very frequent, you cut back the juniors until you have enough water left for anyone who's at the senior end of the scale. The code also provided that going forward from 1909, you would acquire a water right by first applying to the state for a permit. So you had to ask before you just started putting water to use. After you developed your water use according to the terms of your permit, then you would come in and do what's called proving up your water use, and you would be issued your actual water right in the form of a water right certificate from the state. A quick sidebar here, something that we'll come back to in a few minutes. There are a couple of important things about a water right, you know, when you have one. And the certificate sets out these components. You have a source of water that you're allowed to take your water from, either groundwater or surface water. You have a type of beneficial use that your right is for, irrigation, municipal use, domestic, something like that. You have a specific amount of water you're allowed to divert and use. You have a priority date. You have a place of use, and the water right becomes appurtenant to that place of use. You have a point of diversion, where you can take the water either from a well or from a surface diversion. And you have a time of use. And all of those elements are fixed components of your water right. Even once you have an official, you know, water right certificate from the state, it's still subject to the use it or lose it requirement. And so what is a water right? Well, it's a usufructuary right, one of my favorite terms in water law. It's a use right rather than an ownership right. And it's defeasible subject to this condition subsequent of continuing to use it beneficially according to the terms of the various components. Okay, but by 1909, when the water code was adopted, there were already plenty of people using water around the state, as you can imagine. I mean, the Oregon Trail, you know, happened in the mid-1800s, lots and lots of settlements. And these uses were perfectly legal under pre-code law. Oregon originally, before the 1909 code, recognized both riparian rights, which arise from living on the banks of a water course and having the right to a share of water from that water course to use on riparian land, and prior appropriative rights. And we recognized the riparian rights because the first parts of the state to be settled were the wetter areas, and we sort of imported the riparian law from the eastern states. But we started recognizing prior appropriative rights early, before the code as well, growing out of the customs of the California gold fields and the fact that much of the state originally didn't have a lot of water, the eastern part of the state, and it didn't have a lot of riparian owners. It was a lot of federal public land at the time. So these two systems were both bubbling up before the code chose one over the other going forward with the prior appropriation doctrine. And so those rights were legitimate even if the water user didn't have a piece of paper from the state to prove it. Another thing that existed prior to 1909 was federal reserved rights. The 1906 case of U.S. versus Winans and the 1908 case, these are two U.S. Supreme Court cases of U.S. versus Winters, both provided that Indian tribes in particular, Indian reservations that were created out of the federal public lands, came with an implied water right as a creature of federal law to fulfill the purposes of the reservation. Those rights were inchoate. I mean, they weren't specified as to how much they consisted of, but they existed according to these two significant U.S. Supreme Court cases. So all of this is there, existing and legal before 1909. So one of the really important pieces of the Water Code was to provide a process for determining these pre-code rights and the federal rights, and then fitting them in with the rights that would be issued by permit by the state after 1909. And this is called the adjudication process. Sometimes you'll hear the term general stream adjudication. That's what's often used when we're talking about a surface water source. Or you might hear basin adjudication when we're talking about a groundwater aquifer. And this, again, was not unique to Oregon. This is something that happened all over the West, because in every situation before the comprehensive codes were adopted, there had been rights acquired either through recognition of historic riparian rights or by just taking the water and putting it to beneficial use and being recognized by custom and early state law that was legitimate. So every Western state in its water code has an adjudication process of some sort. Originally, the water code only applied to surface water, but in 1927, groundwater east of the Cascades was added, and then in 1955, groundwater statewide was added. And the same prior appropriation system applies to groundwater as to surface water, and virtually the same adjudication system as well, but they are generally adjudicated separately. So, groundwater is adjudicated in one proceeding and surface water in another. I'm going to come back with more detail about the adjudication process in a moment, but I want to talk about this other important component of the Water Code, and that's the transfer process. That's a little bit of a misnomer. We call it that. We call it the transfer process. Everybody in the West calls it the transfer process. It doesn't always mean a transfer of property or, transfer from one person to another, that something's changing hands. And this is where you have to go back to the sidebar. Remember what I said about the components of a prior appropriative right being fixed: the source, the type of use, the place of use, the point of diversion, and so forth. If you want to change any of those things, you have to come into the Water Resources Department and request a permission to change, and that's called a transfer process. It may be that the water right is not changing hands, the property may not be changing hands, but the type of use may be changing. Or it could be that the water right is being separated from the land, with the land being sold and the water right being retained, and a change in place of use perhaps being requested. You can't change the priority date, because that's the most important thing. You wouldn't want to change the priority date if you have a good senior right. You can't change the amount of water, but you can change these other aspects. Sometimes you can do a source switch. Sometimes you can change the place of use. You might be able to change the type of beneficial use, and you can change the point of diversion. If you just sell the property and you don't retain the water right, you don't need a transfer proceeding. The water right automatically goes with the property to the new owner. But if you want to change any of these other things, whether you're keeping the property in the same hands or whether it's changing hands, you need the permission to do that. And so, again, I'll come back to some more detail about the transfer process, but let me talk a little bit more about adjudication and transfer and how they both work and how they come together or not in some situations. Adjudication. I'm not going to go through every step in detail, or we'd be here all day or as long as the adjudication processes themselves take. But here's a basic summary. In Oregon, we have a two-phase adjudication process. We have an administrative phase and then a judicial phase. Some other states do it similarly. Some other states do it slightly differently. Either more takes place in the agency or more takes place in the court. The Water Resource Department has slightly different roles in each state. But the way it works here, the first phase of the adjudication is an administrative process. And again, oversimplifying to some degree, but the Water Resource Department essentially notifies everybody who might have a claim to a pre-code right. Because remember, the adjudication is only for pre-code rights, because the permit system is the registry and the determination for everything after 1909. So they notify anyone who might have a claim to a pre-code right in a particular basin, if it's a groundwater basin or a river basin. tells them to come forward and submit their claim. Then it's a very lengthy, potentially, depending on how many claims you have, it's a very lengthy administrative process of proving up those claims. You know, the person who has a claim has to submit proof of their claim and recognize that we're talking about stuff that goes back, you know, 100 years. So trying to show proof that the water was applied from the beginning and has been continuously used is sometimes challenging. So the person who's making the claim brings in their evidence. Every claim is subject to challenge or contest by other parties. So other parties may say, oh, no, you don't have that right. I have a senior priority to you for that amount of water from that source. So the administrative process accepts the proof for the claims or the statements of claims. It then hears objections to those claims in sort of contested case, you know, quasi-judicial procedures. And then finally, after resolving all of those issues, issues a decision that essentially tallies or lists all the claims and their components. So their priority dates in order, the source, the type of use, the point of diversion, and so on. Using the Klamath just as an example, the Klamath started in 1974. Klamath adjudication started in 1974. So when I say lengthy, I mean really lengthy. Now there are some in the Southwest, like the Gila River in Arizona and places like that, that started in the 20s and, you know, kept going until just a few years ago. Takes a very long time to get all these claims on the record and heard. The Klamath started in 1974. There were approximately 1,200 notices of intent to file claims, and then ultimately 730 claims were actually submitted. And there were something like more than 5,600 contests filed. Just contrasting, you know, Snake River Basin adjudication in Idaho, that started in 1986, and there were 150,000 claims in that process, and it involved 90% of the groundwater in the state of Idaho. But in any event, these are very complicated, lengthy processes. Some places, some states put together special courts. You know, Idaho put together a special Snake River Basin adjudication system. Other places construct their administrative process around them. Once the agency issues its decision on the administrative front, that's not the end of the road. That decision then needs to be filed in court, in the county circuit court for whatever counties are included in that river basin adjudication. And then it's subject to a whole new round of contests or protests in the court proceeding. And of course, it can go all the way up through the Oregon courts to the Oregon Supreme Court, you know, if there are appeals. And then if there are federal rights at issue, such as treaty rights, it can jump to the United States Supreme Court for review as well. And that means that the judicial process is also likely to be a very lengthy process if there are controversies in the adjudication. After all the appeals are finalized, after all the court process, whatever that is finalized, you have a final decree, and then the decree does the same thing that the administrative decision does. It lists by priority date, in priority order, all of the rights, all of their places of use, all their types of use, the amounts of use, the points of diversion, and so forth. And then the Water Resource Department will issue water rights certificates on the basis of the decree, as just like you would if you came through the permit process after 1909. A couple of other things about the Klamath particularly, because it's the best and most lively example we have of this stuff right now. Much of the state was adjudicated starting years ago. You know, I was just working with a client on a matter in the John Day basin, and there was a decree in John Day in the 1920s. You know, there are some earlier ones than that, some later ones. You can imagine that the earlier decrees weren't quite as detailed in the kinds of proof that were submitted, the kinds of contests that took place, so forth. But they've been going on for a long time. Just happens that, the Klamath was a really big one and wasn't started until the 70s. One of the things that has been at issue in the Klamath as well, or one of the things that has built in time, is that because there are some very important Federal Reserve rights at issue in that case, there were a couple of runs up to federal court that halted some of the, you know, some of the decisions in the state adjudication for a while. And then once the federal court decided some of those issues, then got reinstituted in the state proceeding. I mentioned that Federal Reserve rights existed prior to 1909 by virtue of these couple of significant U.S. Supreme Court cases. At the same time, it wasn't until the 1950s that the U.S. Congress waived sovereign immunity and allowed the state adjudication, state adjudication proceedings to pull in the federal rights for determination. So up until that point, they had to be determined in federal court, if at all, and you couldn't just sue the federal government, you know, to find out what their claim was. So in 1952, Congress passed what's called the McCarran Amendment. Senator McCarran happened to be from Nevada. He was really interested in water issues. The McCarran Amendment allowed or waived the sovereign immunity of the federal government to allow Federal Reserve rights to be determined in state adjudicative or general stream adjudication proceedings. You have to apply federal law to those claims, however, because they are creatures of federal law. So you're considering both types of claims in the same proceeding. The other thing that's illustrated very well in the Klamath is that until you have under Oregon law, until you have the administrative decision, which I said, you know, comes after this very lengthy administrative process, and in the Klamath, that administrative decision just came last spring, March 2013. So started in 1974, went to federal court a couple times, final decision by the agency in March of 2013. Now it's in the court in Klamath County. Until you have that administrative decision, you don't have specific decreed right or even declared rights for the pre-code folks. And so the Water Resource Department has always taken the position that they cannot enforce in favor or against of those pre-code rights because they haven't been determined yet. So in the Klamath Basin, there are all these pre-code rights, and then there are also post-1909 rights issued by permit. The only things that the department has been able to regulate and enforce are the permitted rights. And so there hasn't been enforcement against or on behalf of these earlier rights until last spring. And once the state statute says that once the what's called the findings of fact and order of determination are issued by the department, then that is enforceable while the thing is winding its way through the judicial review process. So that's why the Klamath tribes and the Bureau of Reclamation were able to make a call on their water rights last summer stimulate enforcement of those rights in the Klamath Basin for the first time ever. It hadn't been done before. And the tribal claims and the Bureau of Reclamation claims in the Klamath are very significant. They're early. The Bureau of Reclamation has a 1905 date, so that's a pre-code right. And the tribes have time immemorial rights to in-stream flows of water. Okay, so that's kind of how the adjudication process works, and we're, you know, years away from a final determination in the Klamath. The transfer process, how it works is if you want to make a change to your water right, again, you come into the Water Resource Department, you say, I want to change my point of diversion, or I want to change my type of use from irrigation to municipal, or something like that. And the department gives notice to everyone else who is in the same water source, basically. I mean, that's a little oversimplified. But they give notice to other parties who are likely to be affected by those changes. And any of those parties can come in and protest that they will be injured by the change. So this is the way in which the prior appropriation doctrine actually protects the junior water holders to some degree. You kind of get to take the system as you find it when you come in as a junior, and if somebody wants to change their point of diversion or change their place of use or type of use, the department will only approve that if there's no injury to other existing water rights. So those processes as well can be lengthy. I mean, nothing like adjudication, but it can take a couple of years or more for a transfer process to be completed when there's a contest and the requirement for showing or proving injury or defending against injury. Now, the point at which these two processes come together, or not, as I said, is the statute that sets out the transfer process says, okay, here's what can be transferred. The first category is adjudicated and decreed water rights. They're not decreed until the court's done with them. Second category, certificated water rights. So again, anytime you've made it all the way through the process and you've proven up your right and you've been given a certificate, those can be subject to transfer proceeding. The third category, permitted water rights. So you've got a permit, but you haven't gotten to the certificate stage. Permitted water rights when the request for a certificate has been received and approved by the Water Resources Commission. So you're basically almost there. You know, not quite, but almost there. And then the fourth category, water rights that are well along in the process of another transfer application when an order approving the change has already been issued and proof of completion of the change has been filed with the Water Resource Department. So there are only four categories of water rights that are subject to the transfer proceeding. The types of transfers available under Oregon law include temporary transfers for up to 5 years, a little bit less scrutiny of the injury, but still the no injury analysis, leases to in-stream purposes for short periods of time, or all the way up to permanent transfers with a complete change. And once a permanent transfer process has been completed, then a new water rights certificate is issued that states the new components, and then those are fixed unless somebody wants to go back and change them. So the rights, one of the categories of rights that are subject to transfer does not include pre-code rights that haven't been adjudicated, and it doesn't include rights that have made it partway through the adjudication process, through the administrative process, but not all the way through to the decree. So those are that's sort of the overview. I'd be glad to take specific questions about any of that or more general questions about water law or whatever you want to do.
Alex? Yes.
I had a quick question. When the water right was being adjudicated, you said that I missed what it could be enforced while it was being the decision. Where did that I missed where all that was? That another court case that said that they could do that?
That's actually in statute. So Oregon statute, okay. And I should be able to quote the section off the top of my head, but I can't at the moment. But the statute says that once you get through the administrative process, the Water Resource Department can enforce their order of determination, even though there's a judicial review process that will ultimately result in the decree.
And when did that become law? Do you remember? Been there for quite a while?
I think it's been around for quite a while. I'd have to check to be sure. Okay. But it's been there for a little while.
And is that what's following?
Yes, please.
And that's what's being followed now in the Klamath Basin?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Bates.
There was just recently an agreement between some ranchers and the tribes, I believe, in the Klamath Basin. What was that about? What actually was the agreement they came to? Remembering there's no water there now. What's going to be really tough this year?
It's a very complicated agreement, and I would not want to try to speak authoritatively about it. But what, you know, the attempt is to recognize that the attempt is to try to get to a place where most of the tribal rights can be satisfied in stream, but the ranching activity in both the upper basin and the Klamath Project area, which is the lower basin, can still keep going, and the wildlife refuges that also have federal rights can, I mean, it's an attempt to make everybody as whole as possible, but as you point out, not everybody can be whole because there's not enough water to go around. And this is the case in many parts of the state. At certain times of the year, the streams are over-appropriated, so there are more paper water rights on record than there are flows in the stream, and that's certainly the case in the Klamath.
Yes, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. In the case down there with the tribes, I assume they can transfer their water rights if they want.
Not so simple an answer to that. There have been some federal statutes that have been enacted that specifically give tribes the right to transfer their rights, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the tribes or against the tribes in this situation, but the argument on the other side is that these tribal rights are attached to the reservation just like everybody else's rights, and if they're in-stream rights, that, you know, they're attached to those purposes. If they're agricultural rights, which many of the tribal rights around the West were found to be, there's a very vociferous argument that they can't transfer those, and that if they're going to transfer them, they have to go through the same kind of no injury analysis that a state right would have to go through. The tribal argument is we don't have to play by the state's rules. You know, this is a creature of federal law. We should not have to go through a state transfer process. And if these rights were given to us as part of self-determination and our sovereignty, then maybe we should be allowed to transfer them. In most situations, the transfers that have occurred of tribal rights have either been as a result of specific federal statute allowing that, or more often by virtue of negotiation with the state and the tribes and other affected water users. So coming to a negotiated agreement that then either gets written up in state or federal law or both.
As a sovereign nation, are they bound by our state and federal laws, or do they deal out their own on their own playing field?
There have been volumes written about that question. They're called quasi-dependent sovereigns, and they are sovereign. They are not necessarily subject to state laws. They are certainly subject to federal laws. I mean, the Congress has the plenary power over the relationship with the Indian tribes. There's a series of both statutes and Supreme Court cases that kind of lay out when tribal law applies within the boundaries of a reservation, when state law might apply to that same area. You know, there's conflict over criminal jurisdiction, civil jurisdiction, and there have been, again, lots of either negotiated agreements or statutes that try to sort that out.
Who has regulatory authority over the transfer of their water? Is it the tribes themselves? Is it water resources? Or is it the federal government? Or is it all three?
There is an argument for each. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be vague, but it's not a settled question. I guess that's the thing I want to say.
So let me follow up, just looking at it from a different perspective. So we're talking here about water use, and so the ownership of the water resides with the state?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Even if it's on federal land, it still resides with the state?
Yes. Back in the late 1800s, when the federal government was essentially disposing of federal land in the West, there were statutes and Supreme Court decisions that pretty much said the federal government could take charge of the water, but they're not. They're sort of severing the water from the land. They're still in charge of disposing of the land, but state water law will govern the waters, except as to these very specific provisions of federal law, such as reserved rights. You know, when the federal government took property out of the general public domain and put it to a dedicated use, like an Indian reservation or a military reservation or a national forest, it came with implied water rights as of the date the reservation was created to fulfill the purpose of the reservation. And that's grounded in the power of the federal government under the property clause, you know, to take care of their land, to take care of federal land. But for the most part, states were given charge over the water.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, you know, from, you know, in the earliest days, the focus was on surface water and flowing water, right? But that notion of state ownership was later applied to wells and groundwater.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. So the declaration in state statute that all waters belong to the state, or to the trust, to the public and the state, applies to both surface waters and groundwaters.
So an owner can own a well, but not the water in it. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. And it's an odd kind of property right you get when you have a water right, because it's a use right as opposed to an ownership right. And it's a use right with all these specific components and conditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I ask a question. When you mentioned a well, where does a residential well fall? I know we have to report them, but
there's an exemption.
We can just go ahead and drill them. Right.
Yes, there's an exemption. Under Oregon statute, the exemption is for up to 15,000 gallons a day, which is a whole lot of water. If you have a well that is just for domestic residential purposes, or even a couple, you know, more than one house, but still basically for domestic purposes, it's exempt from acquiring a state water right up to 15,000 gallons a day. And as of just a couple of sessions ago, those rights now need to be registered. And, you know, the reason for the registration statute was to try to get a handle on how many exempt wells there are and what the total impact of those is. Because meanwhile, you know, if we're acting like we have all this water to hand out in water rights and some of it's already tied up in exempt wells, there's an information gap. So
basically what you said, is there at any time do we, the populace, own the water? Like, you know, it's God's water until it hits your grass, and then it's yours when it's on your grass. As soon as it goes through, it's the state's. Do we at all?
That's kind of, that's pretty close. I mean, when you've reduced, you know, it's treated by the law as personal property once you've reduced it to your possession, sort of. But that also assumes that you're reducing it to your possession according to all the legal requirements of your water, you know, that you have a water right or an exemption and that you're using it accordingly. But up until you do that, it belongs to the public, and after you let it go, it belongs to the public. Or to the state.
Janet, I wonder if you could talk a little more about the grounds under which a transfer application could be rejected. I mean, the focus of it is this no injury to someone who's more senior or someone who's downstream, right?
Or junior, yes.
Or right, yeah. But there's also this notion of beneficial use, right? And so the department can't judge the use that you're going to transfer the water for, can it, or can it to some extent?
Good question. Initially, and I'm going to back up for a second before I directly answer that, that when an initial new water right is applied for, one of the reviews it goes through is a public interest review. And so there's an opportunity there to, you know, to look very broadly at all the characteristics of the proposed water use. As a matter of practicality, though, if it's sort of an accepted use, you know, irrigation, manufacturing, domestic use, and so forth, it's not going to get denied. In fact, there's a presumption that water uses are in the public interest, and so it's sort of the job of an opponent of issuing a water right to prove that it's not. And there, you know, there are factors in the statute, but it's a fairly broad, somewhat mushy test. At the transfer stage, there's no public interest review. So the only review is the no injury review. I should inject one more thing. One thing that might happen during a transfer process is that someone else comes in and says, you know what, you've forfeited your water right because you stopped using it for 5 years. You know, you violated the use it or lose it principle. And in fact, you don't have anything to transfer, or you have less to transfer than you think. So that can actually, the forfeiture issue can come up. It can get converted into an actual cancellation if there's evidence of forfeiture. But generally, the major review is the no injury review. And it can be tricky to show injury or to disprove injury because in a lot of situations, our water diversions are not closely measured. And there's an assumption that everybody's using kind of within their water right, and there's often an assumption by downstream water users that they're using return flows from the upstream folks, and that's once it's been let go, as I said, it goes back into the, you know, to the pot for the public, and they're entitled to those return flows. So one form of injury can be a change in return flows that would hurt downstream users. And that can occur with either a change in type of use, a change in place of use, or a change in point of diversion as well, because if you're moving the point of diversion, you're also changing where the return flows are going to come back. It's often very hard to prove what the return flow has been and what you know, if you've been relying on return flow or what. So, but that's one of the types of injuries that there could be.
And essentially, we're talking about volume of water, but there can be some cases where flow rates can be impeded by the kind of diversion, right? And so,
yes.
How is that monitored?
One of the components of your right is your rate of, you know, you get an amount of water you get to use, but often that's stated in terms of a rate of diversion. So, you know, 0.5 cubic feet per second you get to divert at a particular point. If, and I can speak to this one from personal experience, when I'm on the Freshwater Trust Board, and I was on the Oregon Water Trust Board before we merged to become the Freshwater Trust, and one of our early transactions had to do with okay, let me see if I can remember this correctly. We were trying to change the timing of use of a water right. So a water right had been used for irrigation, and it had been diverted and applied to the ground at a particular rate through a period of the irrigation season. The water trust, the individual who had the water right wanted to transfer it to the water trust for conversion to an in-stream flow, and we were asking to shape that water use differently to benefit fish later in the summer. And that became a focus of an injury analysis. You know, could we do that? Would we be changing it too much by shifting the time we wanted to see it in stream as compared to the time that it was being taken out and used for irrigation? And that, indirectly, that's also a return flow analysis. You know, if it had been used for irrigation, there might have been return flow, and we wouldn't be allowed to take that away.
And that's a decision that's made by the department?
Yes. And it can go to a contested case, you know, with the administrative hearings, judge, and so forth.
I have a question. And this is kind of fundamental. But I live in an area, I live on the Mullalla River, and I know a senior water user is at the mouth of the Mullalla River. Now, you talk about returning water and people can use return water, but those people that are upstream, you know, up like more like Mullalla, how do they get that use? Because he gets all his water, and then they're junior users as it goes down the line. So how do they know how much they can take without impacting the guy that's right down there at the mouth?
That's a really good question.
It's a backwards situation.
It is, and it's often that way because lots of times, you know, bottomlands or, you know, areas down lower in elevation or near the mouths of big streams, those often were the ones that were settled first, and then, you know, settlement sometimes moved up the stream. So you often have senior users downstream from junior users. What happens is if you have a wet year, maybe there's plenty for everybody. So the juniors are diverting whatever their water right says they can divert, and push comes to shove, if the senior's not getting, you know, if the senior goes out to their point of diversion and turns their crank and there's nothing there, they call the water master, or they call their water right. But what they really do is they call the water master and say, turn off the juniors, I'm not getting my right. And then the water master will say to the juniors, okay, you need to cut off your use until there's enough showing up at the way downstream for the senior user to satisfy their water right. Unless it would be a futile call. So in other words, if because of the, say, because of the either evaporation or permeation, of, you know, sinking into the ground of the water, if the water wouldn't even get there if the juniors cut off their diversion, then it's a futile call and the juniors still get to use it. But generally, the seniors get to say, give me my water, no matter where they are on the system.
Does follow? Mm-hmm. Does environmental take precedence over regular water use? I mean, so the fish can have a place to swim?
No. The way that, you know, water law is old. Water law is property law from way back in common law in England. And even before that, you know, in ancient law. Environmental laws, of course, have mostly come in since about the 60s and 70s. So you have this old system of property law with this mental mylar, if you will, this overlay of environmental laws, and they don't fit very well together. Many of the environmental laws, however, are federal law. And so to that extent, there's a supremacy issue, you know, that they can, in fact, trump the underlying state law. But if you're talking about a property interest, then you have the constitutional takings argument sometimes against the imposition of environmental law. And that's happened in the water setting quite a bit. The Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, have their application to change the way people use their historical water rights has been challenged in a couple of different situations as an unconstitutional taking of my property right. So that's something that's still kind of, the friction there is not entirely resolved in the courts.
And just one follow-up query. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how all this works.
That's it, I have a related one.
You have a stream coming down, and another stream comes in and intersects it, a smaller one intersects. But a water right user is downstream of that intersection. Where are his water rights defined from? Is it from the larger stream or from the combination of the streams?
It depends on the system. I mean, it depends on the hydrology, sort of. So
it's the malal in the pudding, I'll just
okay.
tell you.
So if your right says, you know, you get to take out of the Pudding River, and somebody else's right says they get to take out of the Malala River, again, it's going to be the water master's call based on sort of historical evidence. You know, are they going to cut off the Pudding person so that it goes downstream and gets to the Malala person? And they certainly could under current law.
Okay.
I mean, there lots of times, the water masters tend to see how these systems work over time. And so sometimes by the time it gets to the main stem, it's diffuse enough that you can't really say that cutting off that particular person's right is going to help me way down here. But technically, it could be.
Thank you.
So in practical terms, going back to Senator Olson's question about the environmental, potential environmental conflict with a person's water right, so who determines that? I mean, the water right and all the adjudications around that are through the Water Resources Department, and then the environmental potential would be through ODFW, the DEQ, or, you know, if it becomes a question of turbidity.
Yes.
Or
it works in a couple different ways. So, for instance, talking about a new water right, if, you know, a new application comes in, ODFW and DEQ are going to be commenting into that permit process, and part of what they'll comment on is the water quality issues, the fisheries issues. There are some special rules in the Water Resource Administrative Rules that deal with sensitive fishery areas, and so that, you know, the rules are a little different for some of those areas already because of the existence of the problems and the federal restrictions. So that's how it works with new water rights. With existing water rights, it's a real collision of two systems that don't fit very well together. And so what you have there is let me use the California example. Several years ago in the Tulare Lake Irrigation District in California, or Tulare Lake Basin, the Bureau of Reclamation has water deliveries that it makes to farmers for irrigation. Those farmers have state water rights, but they also have delivery contracts from the Bureau of Reclamation. As a federal agency, the BOR has to comply with Endangered Species Act requirements for consultation and so forth. So back quite a few years ago, the Bureau in California said, we're not going to deliver as much irrigation water out of the Central Valley Project to the irrigators as they've had in the past because of endangered species requirements. In that case, the irrigators sued the federal government in the Court of Claims because, you know, in order to get damages from the federal government, you have to go to the Court of Claims. They sued the federal government in the Court of Claims and said, this is a taking of our property right to water, and you owe us compensation, you know, to deliver us less. And in a fairly complicated decision, the Federal Court of Claims found in the irrigators' favor. There have been other similar cases where, you know, if you change any of the facts about the type of contract with the Bureau of Reclamation, the type of state right that was issued, all those kinds of things contribute to a decision as to whether there's a unconstitutional taking or not. And the Tulare Lake was sort of the first one that actually kind of lined everything up in such a way that it was found to be unconstitutional. The Klamath farmers hired the same lawyers as the Tulare case and took one of these issues to the federal claims court as well. And that is a whole different complicated story. But because it's the other way that it can happen. And if it doesn't come in on the new water rights through the various programs and commenting agencies, it's existing water rights, it can give rise to a takings claim. Or at the same time, using the Klamath again as an example, in the 2001 crisis in the Klamath, it was the Pacific Coast Fishermen's Federation and some environmental groups that sued the Bureau of Reclamation, not in the Court of Claims, not for damages, but in federal court, claiming that they were not complying with the Endangered Species Act because they were continuing to let water go to the irrigators instead of taking care of the two endangered fish in the basin. And the federal court said, you plaintiffs are right. They told the Bureau of Reclamation to correct the balance and start taking care of the fish, and that was what gave rise to the first round of water cutoffs in the Klamath. So it was a completely different situation than what happened last summer, but an example of how the environmental laws can sometimes affect the water deliveries.
And the recent settlement doesn't have anything to do with that, is that right?
No. I mean, the recent settlement tries to comply with the Endangered Species Act, but it also deals with the dams and restoration and irrigation efficiency. I mean, there's so many pieces to it.
Yes, Senator. Yes.
Really appreciate your conversation today. It's been very helpful. And it just struck me. Early on, you said that the water right was a use right? And you had a word for it that was?
Usufructuary.
Usufructuary. Well, it really struck me because I'm from Eastern Oregon in Umatilla County, and our irrigated land is worth $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 an acre. Dry land in that same area, a couple hundred maybe. So, and that's a outright property right. You own that land. But the value of that land to you, both in production and in property value, is what you're able to apply to it that you don't own.
Right. Well, you own a use right.
You own a use right, but it isn't a property
not
right.
Not a fee ownership right, like fee you have
ownership,
the land.
And so it gets really, I can see the complexity of it, where your value is based upon a use right to an entity that can be taken from you or rearranged or whatever, or the different things you've talked about, the complexity of it.
But at some point it bumps up against, there's only so much that can be changed about it before it does bump against the constitutional takings argument. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody would agree that that's, that there is some limit there. But it's different than land. I mean, land was never declared to be a publicly owned resource handed out for use only. And water was.
Paul, yes, but the West was settled because the land increased its value when you were able to apply that to agriculture production.
And that's exactly the origins of the prior appropriation doctrine, that in the eastern states where there was sort of plenty of water and plenty of streams, the riparian doctrine said anybody who lives on the bank of a stream has an equal correlative right to a reasonable use of that water, but only on riparian land. When you came out west, fewer water courses, farther between, a lot of public land at that time, and the prior appropriation doctrine is a very utilitarian, pro-economic development doctrine. It said, take the water out of the stream. We don't care if you use it on riparian land. You can take it, miles away to the nearest gold digging as long as you do something beneficial and productive with it. And that, started the system of water rights in place. And then it's many years later when we sort of realize that a dry stream is not necessarily the best for all purposes, and now we're trying to rearrange all of these things.
Plus, in the West, you had more water when you didn't need it than you had when you really needed it, oftentimes. May I do one other quick follow-up?
Sure.
To answer, or just comment on Senator Olson's as a former county commissioner. Our water master, like, for example, my Butter Creek, as he would send, as the water got less and less, he would notify and they would begin to shut off the lower. It's a part of what our state water resources does department, because there were a lot of streams that over in the Melton Freewater in my county, we as county commissioners would get notice that they were starting to shut it off. But it's so much a part of the system, it doesn't surprise anybody, because they know in August, if it's a short year, they're going to have to, at certain dates, the water will be shut off. And
right. And in most cases, I mean, in a lot of cases, it works without a lot of regulation or oversight by the state, because everybody kind of knows where they are in the system.
Yeah. The other, so one benefit, Senator Hansel, is if you don't get water to that land, it becomes dry land, your property taxes go down. So that's a consolation there. But and I'm
it's
saying
it's all
that,
on farm yes, deferral, so I'm, not a whole lot.
I say that very facetiously. I mean, there is, you know, and as you know, as a county commissioner, is a real impact then on the county resources.
That's true.
So everything's kind of interrelated here.
Absolutely.
Senator Hansel, he's a city slicker.
Well, Janet, thank you very much for coming.
You're very welcome.
Really good. Appreciate it. I think we veered a little bit over to Water 101, but it was very useful for me when we did that. But I think we're in a much better position now to have the conversation on Wednesday about the Klamath. So,
great. Thank you very much.
Colleagues, any questions or anything for the good of the order? We do have we got a first set of amendments on the Klamath bill, but they're not exactly right, and so they're being redrafted now. As soon as we get them, we'll send them out to you and try to get them out to the public as soon as we can. Okay. So with that, colleagues and audience, we are adjourned.